You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
We saw strong results from the tech giants helping the S&P 500 climb 5.5% last month. We saw the Nasdaq rising 6.8%. Other sectors didn't fare nearly as well, as we saw many US states rowing back on opening their economies in the face of surging coronavirus infections. We've also seen the decline in the dollar combining with super low real bond yields being a boon for gold. But the animal spirits feel a little cautious as we enter August. It's time to catch up with Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment. Chris, hope you're keeping well.
Yeah, very much so. Evening, Michael, and evening to all the listeners.
What's the update on the COVID front? As I said, we have seen some US states rowing back on opening their economies. What are we seeing in terms of growth rates around the world, in the US and Brazil in particular, because they're really the big ones?
You're quite right. So the latest numbers, the latest global numbers, have actually been quite encouraging. On average, we're looking at about 260,000 infections per day. But that's only up 3.5% week on week. And that's hugely significant because that's the lowest growth rate that we've seen since the middle of May. I mean, over the past month or so, we've been looking at growth rates of about 10 to 12% week on week. And that's fallen away. And it points to the possibility of us being close to the global number, peak number of infections. But having said that, we do need to be careful because the US, Brazil, and India alone, just those three countries, account for 60% of all new infections any given day. And so the global number is being heavily determined by what's happening in those three countries alone. And the latest data out of the US is encouraging. It seems that many of the states are starting to roll over despite the fact that they are imposing new restrictions, or maybe because they're imposing new restrictions. The number of infections is decreasing. And in Brazil, it's decreasing. And in fact, in South Africa, it's decreasing as well. So it's really only India, amongst the countries that are heavily infected at this point, that remains a concern. And as a result, we do seem to be getting some good numbers globally, or rather they're simply less bad than they were before.
Yeah, less bad. And what worries me about what you said as well is that causal effect there. Is that because we've seen such tight restrictions, and might we see a reversal if we see economies opening up too quickly? I'm reminded of what we see over in the Antipodes with the Kiwis having an unfortunate laugh at what the Australian cousins are battling with over the ditch. But it just shows you how quickly, if you reopen your economy too soon, infections can spread. And so I think still big warning signs for countries as they look to deal with this pandemic. Now, what impact is this having on the global economic recovery?
Yeah, so this is some very interesting data. And we track this on a high-frequency basis. It does come from Google and monitor our cell phones and how much time we spend at retailers and transit and at work. And we know from that global economic activity bottomed in April and has subsequently been recovering. But the latest data shows that it's not just the US where we're starting to see a slowdown in recovery. We're starting to see it across developed markets. And actually, emerging markets are starting to catch developed markets. And that's anomalous because if you look at where the burden of the virus lies at this point, it is predominantly in emerging markets, Brazil, South Africa, Mexico, Colombia, Argentina, etc. But despite that, economic activity at this point is increasing at a more rapid rate in emerging markets ex-China than it is in developed markets. It's anomalous, and let's just hope that it persists for South Africa.
That is some very interesting data. Once again, as you say, you track it via Google data, which is as much as near or now casting as you can get, and certainly not what you would expect. You would expect to see developed markets well ahead. Where is South African activity located in that emerging markets bit of good news?
Yeah, so we're sitting at about 30% below baseline. So that means on average, the amount of time that we're spending at retailers and transit and at work is 30% below normal. And if we were to track this series from April through to now, what we see is every time that restrictions are reduced from level 5 to 4, from 4 to 3, from 3 to 3 to advanced 3, we see an immediate uptick in activity. People get out and they go and shop and they meet some pent-up demand. And as a result of that, what it tells us is that when we do start to see a move to level 2 or level 1, we can expect an increase in activity. And the latest data from a virus perspective out of South Africa is particularly encouraging. Our 7-day average number of new infections is down about 20% week on week and is about 40% below the previous high, which was in about the middle of July. So our numbers are improving at a fairly rapid rate, and what that implies is that the next time the president calls us to an evening on a Sunday, one would hope that it's to move to level 2, and that would see an immediate pickup in activity based on what we've seen over the past few months.
Effectively, what you're saying is it looks like South Africa may have already hit its peak.
Yeah, that's what the data is showing, and unless we're going to see a second wave like we've seen in the US, or as you said, we're starting to see in Australia, Hong Kong, and a few other countries, we've certainly passed a peak, and we're down materially off where we were before, and that's true for the Western Cape and Gauteng. There's some provinces where the numbers are still going up, but the aggregate number is meaningfully down on where it was before, and that's not simply because we're testing this. We do have fewer tests out there being conducted, but we have far fewer cases being reported. And so It actually does seem that SA is through the peak.
And it follows through if you look at ICU bed capacity utilization as well. We saw in Gauteng alone that we're about at about 70% and not anywhere also near what we expected to see. And that's down from what we saw in terms of the peak capacity utilization as well, which begs the question around why we've banned things like alcohol. But that's a discussion for another day. GDP report. Reports have been coming in thick and fast around the world. Last week, we saw several countries reporting. The problem is they all report differently. So thankfully, you've gone and squared them off and helped us compare like for like here. What do we see?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a number of ways that countries report their GDP numbers. We're just going to look at it at year on year. So it's Q2 this year versus Q2 the year before. So you don't have to worry about annualizing any given numbers. And it's a more intuitive measure. And it's the way that China reports their numbers too. But what we can see if we look across the world is a couple of interesting facts. First of all, China's actually up year on year already in Q2. So they're well beyond the bottom of the U. They're on the other side of the U. In fact, they're back at normal levels of activity, and they're up about 2% year on year, which isn't the sort of 6% growth rate used to for China, but it's much better than Q1, which was significantly negative for them.
Sure.
That's the first point. They're improving already. The second is if we look at other countries that reported over the past week, like the US and Europe, the US is down about 10% year on year. Europe is down about 15% year on year. And Europe imposed far stricter restrictions to try and combat the spread of the virus, and that had a knock-on consequence for their growth, and we can measure what that was, and it was fairly severe. So Europe down 15, US down 10. But what's particularly interesting is that Europe in aggregate beat expectations. Their minus 15 was about 1% better than consensus was expecting. The minus 10 for the US was about 1% better than consensus expectation. The plus 2 and a bit for China, that's about 1% better than expectation. So across the board, we're seeing GDP prints that are bad, but better than had been expected by a market analyst.
And it's good to know that we've been too pessimistic so that you can always surprise on the upside. What is the latest data showing about the current activity in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, they are surprising in a way that we've simply never seen before. As an example, German unemployment numbers for June came out last week. Instead of consensus estimates of plus 40,000, it was minus 18,000. So fewer people unemployed than had been the case the month before, and significantly below what the market was expecting. And in fact, if you were to go and weight all of the economic data that comes out, unemployment, the retail sales, the manufacturing, et cetera, and you were to go and score a plus if you're surprising on the upside and a minus if you're scoring the downside, the extent of the positive surprises that we're seeing is simply unprecedented in the data that we've got going back 17 years. We've never seen economic data come out this weak for one, but this strong relative to expectations. We've all been too pessimistic with regards to the outcomes, not just in Europe, in the US, and in fact in China.
That is remarkable. There are a lot of remarkable statistics about this recent market sell-off and global recession and the subsequent bounce back. And I think that's certainly the one that stands out for me, Chris, was that it's always quick on the way down, but scarcely so quick on the way back up. But that's certainly what we're seeing and continues to surprise on the upside. Against that backdrop, though, we still see the cooing sound of doves inside the Fed.
No, that's exactly right. And despite the fact that we have picked up various measures showing that economic activity is picking up, the Fed remains very dovish. And the quote that came from Jerome Powell last week was, "We're not even thinking about raising rates," which is one more about thinking than the previous meeting. So in some ways, I suppose that is some form of loosening of policy. But he signaled that it's not on the Fed's horizon at all to hike rates. And that's what's priced into the market. The market's pricing at about a 35% chance that the Fed funds rate will go negative over the next year, which will be the first time that's ever happened. And a 0% chance that we're going to see a hike. So the views are quite clearly, the rates are either going down or remaining flat, but not going up. And the ECB is handing out exactly the same message, and that's exactly what's in the price in Europe as well. Despite the fact that economic data is surprising, there is no hint of central banks looking to even think about hiking rates anytime soon.
Well, not even thinking about hiking rates, as you said there. But what we are thinking about in the market and as investors is earnings, fundamentals. What is going on the earnings front? And I know that earnings expectations let's say they were put so low that people were digging a hole and throwing the earnings estimates in there. And so all you had to do was dodge the hole and you'd be seen to be beating. What are we seeing on earnings now?
That's exactly right. This has been one of the most extraordinary earnings seasons that we've seen yet. We've had about 60% of S&P 500 companies report for Q2 so far. Of those 312 companies that have reported, 80%, just over, have surprised on the upside from an earnings expectation. Now, it's an old game in the US where companies provide some degree of guidance and then they beat by a penny and then the share price goes up during the day. But 80% of companies surprising on the upside is significant. Normally, it's about 65. So there are many more companies beating than is historically the case. That itself is interesting. But it's the scale of the beats that is so fascinating. Normally in the U.S., on average, when companies beat expectations, they beat by about 3% from an earnings expectation. That's normally enough to see a share price up 5 or 6% in a day. What's happening now is that companies, on average, are beating earnings expectations by 22%. We simply haven't seen anything like this. And it's across the board. It's across
on average,
with the exception of perhaps energy and real estate.
No, that is a big number on average. I mean, if you see a couple of outliers doing that, I agree. And that's in the US. What are we seeing across the pond in Europe?
Exactly the same story. The average beat for earnings for Q2 is currently about 24%. And what's so astounding is that these earnings beats have come about in an environment where revenues have come up from companies roughly in line with analysts' expectations. So it's not the case that analysts got the economy wrong. Revenues have been dead bang in line with what they thought. What's happened is that companies have been able to manage their costs and cut their costs far more effectively and quickly than most analysts thought they could. And that may have longer-term consequences. Perhaps some of these companies are cutting to bone instead of muscle.
Yeah.
But the point is, margins have surprised to a degree that we simply haven't seen before, and analysts yet haven't recognized that for their Q3 numbers. They've been too busy trying to deal with the change to their Q2 numbers.
Very difficult forecasting in an environment like this. And as you say, let's hope that those cuts weren't into muscle in terms of consumers and consumer spending and laying off staff. And that then washes out in second round effects on the economy. Fewer people spending, less disposable income, never good that for growth. And we're also keeping a beady eye on inflation because there's been an awful lot of money printing going around. The printing presses are running red hot at the moment. What are we seeing on the inflation front?
Well, this is what's so anomalous. In an environment where the US economy is beating, the European economy is beating, companies are beating, the Fed is saying that they're not going to hike anytime soon. The ECB is saying they're not going to hike anytime soon. Money supply growth in the U.S. is 25%. You would think that cocktail of events would lead to inflation expectations picking up. And they have picked up to some degree in the U.S., but they're still remarkably low. The market is pricing in inflation in the U.S. to average 1.5% over the next decade. The Fed funds target the Fed's target of inflation is 2%. So the market is saying that the Fed is going to be unable to meet its target on average over the next decade, despite the fact that we're seeing all this evidence of resurgence and money printing. which I suspect is not correct. It's not giving enough credit to the Fed. Implicitly, by agreeing with that view, one is betting against the Fed, which has historically proved to be quite unprofitable.
One never bets against the Fed. Now, there's a lot of disagreement in the US as well about stimulus, and the payouts expired on Friday. So there is some urgency to this that the Republicans and Democrats need to sort out. Which way do you see this shaping up?
Yeah, this is hugely important because companies have met expectations of revenue in the U.S. largely because of the stimulus program in the U.S., which has been very generous, $600 per week to individuals earning less than about $100,000 per year. So it's a huge amount of stimulus that's been handed out, and that deal expired on Friday. Now, members of Senate agree that they need to extend the deal, both Republicans and Democrats. They don't agree on the scale, though. Democrats are pushing for keeping it $600 per week until the end of the year. Republicans are arguing for pushing it down to $200 per week. And instead of finding middle ground, Senate adjourned. They took the weekend off. So they're coming back today. They're going to meet 3 o'clock U.S. time to start a hash out. They really need to come to a deal very quickly, because if they don't, what we will see in the U.S. is income fall over a cliff at the end of this week. Now, it might be the case that some U.S. consumers are ready for this. We know that a lot of U.S. consumers saved a large portion of these checks that went their way. The savings rate was over 30% 2 months ago. It was 16% last month. So they can withstand a couple of weeks, but they can't withstand much more than that. And so this is hugely urgent. It is hugely significant for markets. And given how important it is, one would hope they're going to come to some form of agreement. But given how far apart they are, it does seem like it's going to require some very clever and crafty negotiating.
Especially because we're so close to that November election as well. So there's got a lot of real politic about this as well. We're speaking about inflation in the US. Inflation here in South Africa remains quite low. And I say quite low, I think historically low. And we saw the Saab cut at its last meeting, but it was split. What are you seeing on the inflation front in South Africa and by extension and implication, the impact on the ability of the Reserve Bank to cut again?
Yeah, you're quite right. Inflation has come in below the Saab's forecast, and that's been happening for a long time now. It's still very low in South Africa. It's 2.2%. The reason it's so low, though, if we were to break it up by month, is because of the big declines in inflation in April and May because of fuel price declines. Now, we saw a big fuel price increase in July, so that will be reported in next month's CPI number. This month, on Wednesday, we're going to get a very small increase by 5 cents. But what that means is that our numbers will start to drift up, for one. But for two, as long as you've got that April and May number in your 12-month estimate, you're going to land up with very low levels of inflation. So inflation in South Africa, in our view, currently 2.2, is going to drift up to about 3.8 or so percent by March next year. But then what happens is April falls off the base and you get a new April in. The next April, if it's just a normal sort of April, is going to see that inflation rate jump from 3.8 to about 4.5. And then next month, May falls out, you get a new May in, and then it jumps to over 5%. The point being that we expect inflation in South Africa is going to remain below 4% until about March next year. And thereafter, it will pick up. And once it does pick up, it will still remain within the band even out to June next year. So it's going to take some time before we think the Reserve Bank has to be concerned at all about inflation. And I think they are agreeing with that view now.
And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out when it comes to the next meeting. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a hold at the next one. We'll have to wait and see what happens after that. I think it's a bit too much of a crystal ball gaze to pontificate beyond the next meeting. We're running out of time just as I look at the clock here. Chris, you've got a very interesting bit of research on the cost of joining an index. And it's topical because we see Tesla's going to be joining the S&P 500. And it's one of those stocks that has, it's shot the lights out. It's gone parabolic this year. But just talk to me about the cost of joining an index.
This is some fascinating research which was published last week. It was a working paper. And the authors went back over time, over the past 20 years, having a look at what happens to shares when it's announced that they will join the S&P 500 and what happens to them over the subsequent month. And what they found is, from 1997 to 2007, when it was announced that a company was going in, it typically rallied, the company rallied by about 4.5%. And then slowly that performance started to get eaten away. But by about a month later, it was still up about 2% on where it was before. So there was a significant effect of being with an announcement of simply joining the index, you were up about 2%. That effect has completely reversed. From 2008 through to 2017, even if you include or exclude the global financial crisis, the net effect of joining the index is roughly half. So on the day of the announcement, shares only go up about 2% now. They used to go up by 4%. But what's most interesting is a month later, they're actually down on where they were before. And so that index effect is reversed. And it may be because of certain technicalities, like a lot of market participants going short the index participants and long the index. So now they need to short the stock as it goes in.
Yeah.
It might also be because many more people try to game the system. So they can try to estimate in advance if a company is going in or out of the index. So there isn't the same sort of effect on the day that there used to be. But what it does show is that the index effect isn't quite what it used to be. The markets have become more efficient. And if anything, at this point, it seems the stocks tend to be down a month after the announcement now instead of up.
Fascinating. Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investments, with the animal spirits this month. That's a wrap from the team tonight. Thanks, as always, to sound engineer Mataba Taba Radebe and producer Andres Mahlangu. The one, the only maestro, Richard Koch, is up next in Johannesburg. And Sylvia A. is in the Jazz Lounge for you in Cape Town. Good night.